Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for September 25th.
Good, you got it.
I have learned how to look at my calendar on my iPad. And I guess trust it also, which is what the sermon was about.
Looking at the calendar and trusting the calendar?
Yeah.
I made a big point about that in the sermon.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
I don't know. I think you said the word trust in the sermon yesterday, so I kind of just...
Is that the word that stuck to you?
That's the word that was, you know...
What do you just, like, wait for words that stick in your head? And that's your takeaway?
Yeah.
Trust.
And then... Stop sinning. No, I don't think you said that.
What was the sermon on last night? Yesterday, you remember?
It was on Hebrews 11, verse 1.
What other verses did I cover?
I think you covered two more verses, but I feel like you just needed to cover just the one verse.
You think I went on too long?
No, but I don't know if I had the mental capacity to take all three verses in yesterday.
Well, at least you got the basic thrust of the message, which is...
Trust God.
Thanks.
You're welcome. It was a great sermon. No, it was actually really good.
Well, I told a story about our dating when we started off.
Yeah.
To illustrate the point, but I know that probably no one's going to remember the sermon because...
It was a great illustration. It was a great story.
Which means no one's going to remember the
text. Nobody is going to remember the actual text. So, our kids are all up and coughing.
They all have colds. I don't know where they got the colds.
Somebody at church gave it to them as a special present. Mm-hmm. Just like the Word of God. So, today we're going to talk about... I think we're going to talk about the NFL.
Yeah, the kneeling.
And maybe we'll talk about something else, which I also can't remember. But I think we should start with the NFL.
There was something else we were going to talk about. I forgot what it was. I just had it in we were talking about it just before we started the podcast.
I think we should
see how
make
well planned
notes.
This podcast
we
is. We have it.
We should write down what we're planning to talk about because that way we might actually.
Oh,
talk about
I thought
it.
We were going to talk about church politics.
Oh yeah, we could talk about church politics
just a little bit.
I love church politics so much; it's my favorite thing. And I'm trying to make other people love it as much as me. It's not working out.
Yeah.
For some reason, people think that church and politics should not go together. You shouldn't
have
politics.
Right. Well, people hear, when they hear politics, they hear scheming, manipulating, dishonesty. You're trying to gather power to yourself and push people out and make yourself into, you know, queen of the kitchen or queen of the...
Why are you saying queen?
Well, because women usually do that.
Oh, I was going to say king of the...
Men don't play political games in
church. Oh, okay. Oh, right.
but I think they forget... Okay, you get any group of people together, there's going to be politics.
Yes, and I'm saying... I tried to explain this badly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying you should acknowledge that there's politics and that you should engage politically in an explicit way.
So you were talking about political capital, right?
You should. If
what is political capital? How does that
well,
work in a church?
Well, I think that.
Like, if you have someone, pretend someone's listening who has a ministry in a church and they're having trouble getting anyone interested or getting people involved, what's the problem, do you think?
Okay, well, I would say that the basic problem is that they don't have any relationships with any other human beings. And so maybe they think that. It's hard for me to concentrate with our children screaming in their bedroom.
Girls, please stop screaming in your bedroom.
Be quiet. Okay, what was I saying? Okay, so I have a hard time articulating what I'm talking about, but basically, people in the church do work, right? That's one thing that you do. You come to church and... You do work, and as Protestants, we would say that your work doesn't contribute to your ability to go to heaven, and yet you have to do work.
Well, that should be one of the things that comes out of being a Christian is that you want to serve the church.
You want to serve
right.
the body.
And build the body up.
Yeah, because Jesus
mm-hmm.
told you to. It's hard for me to think in the early morning, Monday morning. Okay, so you have to do work, and that could involve sweeping the floor. It could involve going out and doing evangelism. It could involve working with children or taking meals and communion to the sick. It could involve discipling other people, meeting with them in a regular way, being on committees,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
God forbid.
Posey, stop.
All of that counts as work. But one thing that I like at Good Shepherd is that people will start a new ministry
mm-hmm.
or they'll decide to do something, take on a task,
mm-hmm.
which requires them to go to other people and get those other people to work with them.
Right. And that's where politics comes in.
And that's where they often think, well, I am doing the pure work of our Lord. And if people loved Jesus, they would sign up for my ministry.
Right. So they put a list down in the parish hall, and then they'll wait for people to sign up. And they'll make an they'll send an announcement, which they should do. They should put a list down in the parish hall. They should make an announcement in the update and have maybe something said from during the announcement time in church. And then they just kind of expect people to sign up, and that's not
going to happen. Their event rolls around, right. and literally nobody has come, and nobody has signed up, and then they think that the whole church doesn't love Jesus.
Right. Right. And that's
actually not true. The church right. does love Jesus. But they didn't do the hard work of getting investment, which is a banking word. They didn't get other people to buy in or invest in their
right.
ministry because they didn't invest in those other people.
Right.
So we're allowed to use the word investment in a spiritual sense. Well, I would like to say, why can't we use the word political capital in a spiritual
realm? What, let's go back to this problem. What do you mean political capital in the context of the problem we just laid
so
out?
So if you have a problem making friends with people or knowing about and discovering who other people are and caring about them at all, I like to use the idea of tell people that you have a bank, you have a bucket of... You could call it money or you could call it capital.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a certain amount of capital that you can spend. You need to be accruing money in money into your account by spending time with people, getting to know other people,
yeah.
filling your bank, which you then can spend. But if you spend all your money in a bad way, if you say you start a ministry and you decide you're going to have everybody come to a meeting, well, you've spent all your capital because everybody came to your meeting.
They've come out of their way. They came to your meeting. The cost of that is they have taken time out of their schedule to come to the meeting.
Yeah, they're not going to do any more work for you now.
Well, maybe not. But they may, if they're excited about it, they may. But, I mean, that's more
if
often.
If you use the meeting to accrue often, even more capital,
right.
which would be hard to
well,
do.
Well, more often, the way it should work is, you know, you say, okay, I want these people in my ministry. I need to start meeting with them, talking to them, having relationships with them, and then kind of share what I'm thinking about as far as this ministry goes over the course of time. And maybe not a long time, but, you know, you could work for a month on this. Say you want to start a ministry going to lower income housing and doing tutoring after school, right? So you want and you know some people in the church who are teachers
would
or
be
her,
good
yeah
would
so,
be good at it.
So instead of like making instead of just making the announcement and just having the sign up sheet, you know, invite some of the people over to your house, have dinner, have
get
lunch,
to know them for their own sake before then, you start right. jamming your program down
right.
their throats,
right? And that's just it sounds cynical. Well, I'm just making friends with him so I'll do my ministry. Well, no, actually, if from the beginning of your time in a given church, you have been doing this, just making friends with people and talking with people and helping them out with their ministries, that's another good way to build up some
capital
influence, is if you're showing interest in other people's work and taking part in it to the extent that you can, then people are going to look at you as someone who really cares about Jesus and who they want to help as well. So over the course of time, you build up a kind of a personal influence And now, as opposed to secular politics, the reason you're building up this influence isn't to gain power for yourself. It's so that you can spread the gospel, so that you can do...
So you can serve the church and build up the kingdom of God.
What you're doing is just recognizing human beings are human beings.
But you're also recognizing your own personal investment. So if you think about your own capital, it makes it personal for you.
Right. What do you mean?
The word selfish came in a bad way. But you have relationships with other people. You have a bank of capital with various other people that accrues to you, and you can spend it.
Can you explain what you mean by that? Wait, what are you talking about? What capital is accrued? How is that different from what we're just saying?
It's not different. I'm just saying it's not like a big pool of capital that the whole church draws on.
Right.
It's your own.
Right. You're
it belongs
up
your own. To you. So you have skin in the game,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not just, you know, your disembodied ministry or your disembodied good intentions. It's your own life that's working out in relationship to other people, which I don't always think gets factored in.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. You're right, but I'm not sure exactly what you're... How is that a different word you're just saying? Is that... Because you're saying you try to reemphasize it on... Or refocus it on, you need to think about yourself.
Well, okay, so you're not doing it to gain power for yourself, but your ministry does have it does affect you personally. So if you don't have any capital, I use the example of the nursery, and you can't get anybody to work in the nursery, because I don't know, there's a variety of reasons that happens, but if you're not able to, then you end up working in the nursery.
Okay, and that's great.
So that's a personal cost to you.
Right.
So it benefits you to not be overworked, to be related to
now,
other people.
Someone apparently thought that was... There's people apparently sometimes react to that and think that's being self-centered. But no, it's being human, because you have to recognize your own abilities and strengths and how much power you have to do things. And if you're continually spending running yourself ragged, what's going to happen is you're not going to be able to do the ministry as effectively as you want to do it. You're going to get worn down and exhausted and burnt out, and the ministry is going to suffer. So you need to realize how much you're spending on various things as well as other people spending on various things.
Right. So I mean, it's very puts people off to think about it in terms of money or capital, but I like the visual of that, because you could use energy. You have a certain amount of energy, spiritual and physical energy and emotional energy to do something.
Mm-hmm.
In some sense, well, it helps some people to imagine that it's a monetary value, because, you know, you can see your money go up and down in your bank account.
Right.
And if you don't have any money, then you can't do anything anymore. If you don't have any energy, you know, if you've burnt out, you can't do anything anymore.
Right.
So you shouldn't do that. You should and you shouldn't burn out other people. This is one way, I think, to keep you from using other people,
right.
Because you have to, quote, invest in them. That means spending some of your money,
mm-hmm.
to get them to spend some of theirs, and so it, of course, it's about relationships ultimately. Right? You have to be related to other people. But I think people use the word discipleship without thinking about its implications. So this is my way of trying to untangle badly the implications of discipleship, which is something the church has to do, which just means having relationships with other people.
Well, I mean, no, because I mean, technically discipleship is you're meeting with somebody and helping that person learn to read the Bible and make decisions in a Christian way in life. That's not what you're talking about,
though. Well, no, but I mean, I think that all the things that happen in the church are about going on together towards Jesus and building up his kingdom and helping people along the way. And so there aren't very many people in the church who meet regularly with one other person and read the Bible with them. Mostly, discipleship, quote, happens over the
At the Bible studies and admission
Bible,
groups.
yeah, but if you're when you get to know people and you become help to them or they become a help to you in your spiritual life, that happens when you're either standing over the donuts at coffee hour or you're working on a project together. And, you know, that's why people think, oh, well, I got to know everybody so well when at the Harps dinner, when I, you know, that's when we were really close. Well, it's because you were relating to other people.
Wait, what are you talking about? You took a leap there. Wait, can you go back and say what? So the Harvest dinner had that?
No, I mean, everybody used to say about the Harvest dinner, well, that was the time when we all came together, and that's when we really got to know each other, and that's, you know, that was the church. That was in its purest and best form, was when everybody was doing the Harvest dinner together. And that's just because at all the rest of the times of the year, nobody was relating in a deeper and more energetic way to all the other people. That the Harvest dinner took the place of actual discipleship in the church.
Right, so no one knows what we're talking about at all, though, right? Because the Harvest dinner was a dinner they used to do every year at Good Shepherd. And
For 100 years.
For 100, yeah, long, long time.
I'm sure last people year, the can first imagine year, what a Harvest dinner is
right,
like.
Right, but there was really, you know, at the time when the Harvest dinner was the key moment when everyone was relating to one another, it was also the time when, you know, there weren't any Bible studies going on during the week. There weren't any ministries going on during the week. It was just that was the only thing that happened every year, really. And so when things did begin to happen, we started doing Bible studies and having ministries going on a weekly basis. What we discovered about the Harvest dinner is it actually expended a lot of people's energy so that every other ministry suffered while we were doing
Harvest dinner.
Because it cost so much.
The cost of the harvest dinner was prohibitive.
Right. So the political calculation there is, okay, I have these people who have a limited amount of energy, like I do too. Well, how best we want them to expend that energy for the kingdom of God. That's a political calculation you're making, and how best can I then harness what energy we're not spending on the Harvest dinner to other ministries? That's also a political calculation, which is trying to figure out how we can.
And how can I get people to agree with me?
Yeah.
Or how can I get people to see that this is a good thing to let go of, for instance?
Right.
That means you have to go down and interact with other people who are not you and talk to them and invest in them and accrue, you know, capital in order for you to then spend some of it to convince them to let go of it.
But that, again, happens over the course of time with their inner relationships, right? You build with people.
And that was that process of getting rid of the Harvest dinner, I would say, was a sort of a bigger sense of discipleship. We were discipling the whole church. We were moving somebody from one group of people from one kind of
ministry framework
to another kind.
Right.
Took years.
Right.
Took 15 years.
And I didn't even think I wanted to get rid of it until it just stopped happening. And people, last year we just couldn't find anyone to do it.
Right, because people realized that it was a bad use of their own capital.
Right, right.
Their own money in the bank.
Right.
I need to think about this some more and write about it somehow.
You do, because I think people misunderstand you when you say politics, or me too, and then when we say politics or self-interest, or because you don't mean it in the term in the way
I don't mean it in an entirely worldly sense, but I do mean it in an embodied, you know, in the way that we're not all pure spiritual beings who have pure spiritual motives. We have bodies. We are in time and space. Jesus came in a body, and politics, people relating to each other in systems and in groups, is a central part of any human activity. And it's not bad. And I would say one reason why I'm thinking about it a lot and trying to sort of redeem it for myself is that in the Episcopal Church, in a sense of sort of spiritual enlightened glory, conservatives withdrew from the political process, from the political game, and ceded the politics of the church to the progressive side.
That happened on the diocesan level and on the parish level.
And the parish level, right. Because liberal people, progressives, got involved in the politics. They got on vestry.
On committees.
They accrued capital to themselves
and won. I spoke to some people who were in churches that slowly, over time, became more and more liberal. And some of the conservatives within those churches saw what was happening. But instead of playing the game, instead of running for vestry, instead of getting on the committees, instead of trying to salvage those areas of influence in the church, they decided, well, we're just going to pray. And that's fine. Pray.
I mean, you should pray. I'm not knocking prayer.
Of course, but that can't
but
be all that you do. Because
just pray.
Because God's probably saying to you,
get on a committee.
Get on a committee.
Have some conflict with people.
The means by which God affects change in a church is often politically. He puts people in places where they have influence, and they have a platform to preach the gospel and to spread orthodoxy into a...
It really has. So all the books that I'm reading about women in the church, like the Little Women and so on, this happens, you get a women's ministry, right?
Yeah.
And all the women get together and they start reading books. And nobody's checking
what books
they're reading. And the pastor figures it's fine, walks away, comes back, realizes it's a hotbed of heresy.
They're all reading.
But he has no political capital. Right. He didn't, quote, invest personally. He has no base. Like, he might say, well, this is terrible, but the women, he can't do anything. Whereas if he would think about it politically, selfishly even, or in terms of his own investment with that group, he would maintain a relationship, at least for political purposes, but hopefully really for discipleship. I think we use the word discipleship in the church when really sometimes we mean politics. I think that's
I don't think so. I think you're confused, because I think discipleship has a very specific meaning when we do it.
I agree with you,
right.
But I think it's thrown around and used in a muddy way to mean more than just what maybe Jesus meant by it. I think the two are tangled up. Anyway, it interests me very much. You can await, I'm sure, a blog post about it soon.
So I think.
I mean, we've talked about it over the years a lot.
We have, because one, stand firm. This is one of the big things. Because when the Episcopal Church was crumbling, Sarah High, who's one of our writers, on Stand Firm, this is one of her key talking points or key emphases, is that. You can't abandon the field and expect the church to.
Her Little Stone Bridge piece was the best thing on the internet
for a long time.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, so I should dig it up and post it, because that's how you can think about that in a bigger sense of the wider church, but you can also think about it in a local context. You know, you have.
Each committee is a little bridge.
It's a little bridge.
And if you let the enemy take the bridge, too many bridges taken, pretty soon
your whole church
is
subverted.
So people need to be involved in there and with each other. And there are no progressives that I know of at Good Shepherd who are trying to push their way into various ministries. But every church is susceptible to being sapped by error in one way or the other. So being on... having your leaders invested in other people in the church and your trusted people always kind of investing time in their areas of influence will keep those bridges safe.
Right. And it's not just as like it is. It's definitely spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely spiritual, mm-hmm. But it's corporeal. You know, it's messy. It's the details. It's, you know, what color should we paint the nursery? You know, who makes the coffee on Sunday morning? That's
who can I ask to do this?
Who shouldn't I ask? Because
there are people you shouldn't ask.
Yeah, there are people you shouldn't ask. And what will happen to my ministry if I do ask them? Or because I didn't even know that I shouldn't ask them. But then I didn't know that I didn't know, so I did. And now I have a huge problem on my hands.
Right.
I mean, the center of the center of the life of the church, wouldn't you say, is really in the kitchen, and the sacristy should be at the pulpit. It is at the pulpit. If the pulpit is like grounded and, but the outworking of the pulpit isn't in the world necessarily. It's in the church kitchen, and who's cleaning out the cupboards. I mean, that's a really important thing for a person to know, is who's cleaning out the church kitchen cupboards.
That's a very important person in the church, and has a lot of influence.
Yeah. So, anyway, we should talk about the NFL.
Last bit about this. You know, we the only problems we've had as a church internally, not the only ones, but the major ones have come when someone who does a lot of work, and because of that work, has built up a lot of capital, has misused that capital.
Yep.
Right, and that so. We've had people who just give themselves over to doing work for people and involving themselves in various ministries. And by doing so, they kind of amassed
a huge amount of capital,
influence. And then they turned against the church itself and used that to kind of pull things apart. So you've got to be careful who has.
That's why I'd like the whole thing to be articulated and explicit. Right. I'd like people at Good Shepherd to have this paradigm in their mind so that they can look at themselves and be honest about issues of power and work and doctrine and spirituality, and be able to look and judge what's going on around them too. I would like it to be an explicit, let's not delude ourselves and think that we are better than we are, for instance.
Right.
Let's acknowledge our human state, which is a political state, and be truthful about our own motives and what we see potentially as the motives of others. Of course, we can be wrong about that. But the human heart is deceitfully wicked. I mean, we can't understand it, but we should try. The Holy Spirit can help us see the deep darkness that lies just under the surface and in the kitchen cupboards of the church.
Right. Yeah, thanks.
Which I think is a perfect segue for the NFL. Because I don't understand what's going on.
Well, last year, Colin Kaepernick...
Colin. I don't think people's names are Colin.
Or it's Colin, whatever.
Kaepernick?
Kaepernick. I thought it was
Kaepernick.
Kaepernick. I don't know. I don't.
Actually, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't have cable this year, so I can't watch football, so I don't.
So you're part of the great boycott
well, not
of
purposely.
America.
I wasn't purposely boycotting the football, but I can't watch it. And I heard the Denver Broncos beat the Cowboys yesterday, apparently. So
they're out right away.
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't watch it.
There's
our parish Denver fan
is really happy.
Yeah, he came in mocking me.
Oh, that's not nice.
Yesterday morning. But I didn't watch it, so.
You're not complicit.
Yeah.
Because
when
you watch it, they lose. But when you don't watch it,
it's all
lose.
Their own thing, right? So anyway, but last year, this guy, Kaepernick, quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, started kneeling at the national anthem to protest racism in America. And I remember now, at the time, I didn't think it was, people were going crazy. I didn't think it was that big of a deal. Look, if you want free speech, why not? We're all worried about what's happening on campus and how little snowflakes can't deal with conservative.
Yeah, so why can't we
deal with a guy who's kneeling at the anthem? I think it's ridiculous to be that upset about it. And so anyway, it spread this year. Lots of teams have people who are kneeling. I think Sunday before last, there were six football players kneeling. And the president decided to say, you know, if anyone kneels, we should boycott, or people should boycott the NFL.
Wait, what president?
Our president.
Like...
Donald Trump.
Oh, I mean, there's lots of...
He said
isn't
the
there a president of the NFL?
No, owners should fire the players that won't kneel.
Oh, so he got involved.
He got involved, right. Oh, so now, this Sunday, I guess, everybody knelt. Not everybody, but almost.
I saw a couple of people who didn't kneel, and they looked very brave alone on the field.
Right, so now it's become a fight, really, between the NFL players and the president.
The entire country.
Right, well, and yeah, so some people are boycotting games. Some people are behind the players, and you know, it's just an interesting little It is, to me, I continue to think, wow, we are so sensitive. I don't care if a $2 million dollar a year football player wants to kneel at the national anthem. Let him do it. And who cares?
I think it's really interesting that he would kneel and deliberately tick off his own audience, which is ultimately what pays him his $1 million salary. I think that's really interesting.
Right.
So he must think, well, I'm always going to draw this fantastic paycheck.
Right. I mean,
I'm never going to be fired.
If you're going to kneel, you should be able to take the consequences as they come, because you can't expect people to say, okay, well, I don't agree with you, but I'm going to keep watching you and
paying my money.
Right. Because I just love you so much.
I love you.
If they stop watching, that's fine. But I mean, I think people who are going to kneel for the national anthem need to recognize that there may be consequences for their future.
I mean, they really are, in a political sense, they really are sticking it in the eye of their own audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because the average NFL player,
average Joe, watches football.
likes and doesn't want to think about racism while he's watching football.
Right.
I mean, maybe he should think about it, but he doesn't want to, so.
Right. I was one of those that I don't know if I could say the Pledge of Allegiance in good conscience anymore, because we're not a nation under God. That's ridiculous. We're slaughtering millions of babies a year. We're not a nation under God. We're a nation that rebellion against God.
I think the Pledge of Allegiance is fascinating. So you were trying to explain to me. I mean, I think I had to say it twice in school once when I came back to America. I had to say it.
Right.
And I don't really understand why you would say it or what it was for. But you told me last night that when you're pledging allegiance, you're pledging to die for the country? Is that what you're saying?
I pledge allegiance? No. Well, you're putting your hand over... You're talking about the hand over the heart.
And you're saying, I would rather die
than... It's your place of life, right? Your heart is where the heartbeat. You're pledging yourself...
To your country?
Your whole self and your fortune to defend and...
I don't understand why I would want to do that. That's where it all breaks down for me.
I was raised as a kid to think every citizen of the United States should be willing to give his life for his country.
I mean,
and that's what you're saying, and you're pledging allegiance. You're saying I swear an oath to defend and protect this country, and I'm loyal to this country.
I mean, I'm basically loyal, but I wasn't really planning to sign up to die for my country.
Well, you're a woman.
Oh. Well, good then. That lets me out.
Well, I don't mind that. I signed up to potentially die for the country when I was jumping out of airplanes and stuff. But I don't think of it as... I don't think of it as an un-Christian thing. But now I think there's some real conflict in this kind of patriotism. I think patriotism is a great thing. But when your country is actually nosediving and in open, defiant rebellion against God... with the blaspheming of marriage, the murder of babies, and yes, racism itself, then, you know, I can totally understand taking a knee. Not because you don't respect the country, because...
I guess I don't get this. I'm just having a huge mental... I don't get it. I think even though you keep saying I'm not getting it. If I was really anxious about racism, I would... I just feel like there were a lot of different ways that I could
deal
with
racism,
that kneeling on a football field would literally be the last thing I would think of doing. But apparently, it's the first and best thing to do.
Well, if you're a player on a football team, everyone sees you, right? So everyone looks up to you. You kind of think of yourself as a celebratory, and you know.
Celebrity,
right? And how do our celebrities act about politics? They always think they have to have an opinion, right? They always have to say,
which also confuses me.
Right,
I don't understand why any movie star thinks that I care at all who they voted
because
for.
Because people do.
I mean, who are these people?
They're fans. They love
they're
it.
Fans.
Who did what? Lady Gaga vote for? I mean, everyone cares about that stuff.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like a lot of people don't care.
Well, not people who. Where you take politics seriously or take government seriously, but the people who may vote
don't
may not care about
who Lady Gaga is going to. Lady Gaga isn't going to vote.
Oh,
how many of these NFL players vote either?
All I'm saying is, look, the point is that if you have a platform and you really feel strongly about something, I think it's, of course, it's just the most natural thing to use that platform to speak about what you feel strongly about. So football players don't get a lot of time to talk in front of a microphone, but they do get, they're on camera a lot. So one of the most visible ways you can protest, if you think you should, is by kneeling during the national anthem. Now,
that's the other thing that I think is really funny, because in my mind, kneeling is like an act of true devotion. So
it's, I think, really it was made as a kind of respectful thing. It wasn't meant to be disrespecting, like, the country, I don't think. I think
for God.
Well, right. That's what I think. Kneeling is supposed to be like
a act of humility.
Right. Not like a proud, I hate this country, and it's more of a.
But people feel like. Yeah, Colin Kaepernick wasn't being humble when he knelt.
No, right. I don't know him well enough to know what he was doing, but I think that it was...
I mean, I don't know him at all. Right. I've never made his acquaintance.
Maybe I'll call him and ask him what his...
Were you adopting a posture of humility before the flag?
Well, no, but I mean,
it
was...
I don't get it.
So, anyway, I think that... I understand the disaffection that people feel, some people feel anyway, for this country. I don't understand why any Christian would be outraged that people are not respecting the patriotic slogans and songs like they used to, since, again, this country is in open defiance against God. That makes perfect sense that there'd be less patriotism on the part of some people, and we shouldn't be upset about that. You know, maybe what we should do instead of getting mad at football players is actually start to reform our country.
I don't know how we would possibly do that.
Well, we could start by outlawing abortion and reforming marriage.
But you keep using the word "we" like that's a thing, you know? Like,
well, I mean, the people who are upset about this whole thing, a lot of people are upset about it, voted for Donald Trump, who is very clearly not going to do anything about marriage. He said that explicitly.
The other option wasn't going to do anything about it either. So people voted for Trump hoping that maybe he would, after all, do some things. You know, he would. There was a sense, I think, that people thought, right. Oh, well, he's going to restore the greatness of our country. That's right. Everybody's confused about why the country's not great. You know.
Why are we confused about why the country's not great?
Well, it's because we don't have a wall yet. That's why it's not great.
That's what it is.
And some other things, but also we don't have the wall. Once we get the wall up and we enshrine Obamacare, we'll be great again. I'm enjoying how many people are disaffected by Trump. Like, Ann Coulter apparently is really angry.
Oh, she turned to what she...
She wrote the book In Trump We Trust, and then now she's really angry because of the DACA thing.
Oh.
And so I thought that was pretty great. I mean, it's more intellectually honest for her to say
we're
that she's unhappy,
into territory that we're going to disaffect our fan. Because we do have Trump
does
supporters.
Our fan... Yeah, that's true. No, I mean, I think our fan isn't a deep, abiding Trumpist. Our fan voted for Trump because of Hillary, which, incidentally, I think that was great of Hillary to come back and remind everybody
why we didn't vote for her.
I thought I was getting ticked off about Trump, but then Hillary decided to do all these interviews and write a book, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's why I wasn't sad when Trump won.
Right.
But still, I don't understand American civic religion at all. And its intersection, its entanglement with actual Christianity, or sort of pseudo-Christianity, mm-hmm. is what I can't wrap my mind around it at all. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, that's why James White got in trouble, because he was having a discussion with a Muslim and actually, you know, trying to present the Christian faith in a clear way and letting the Muslim present the Muslim view in a clear way. And... Well,
that was the worst thing he could possibly have done.
And Brandon House and other Steve Camp came on as if he had betrayed the gospel. Really, they're upset was that he betrayed
America.
It was about America. It was about the flag.
So, Okay, the thing that I can't really believe that the guys who put on their big shoulder pads, again, I don't understand football as a game. Like, I've tried to watch some football, and I cannot understand all of these men in skin-tight unitards with
not unitards.
Helmets.
They're not unitards.
Bashing each other. Looks like they look like...
They're not unitards.
I don't understand why this is like the symbol of American something. Anyway, and then
it's a war. It's you have two lines of battle lined up against each other, and they're pushing the ball forward or back or the other way, and they're, and you know, I grew up watching football every Sunday, and at Thanksgiving especially, you know, there's kind of a American tradition to the game. It used to be baseball was like this, but football has, I think, become, or had become, the great American sport. Everyone watched it. It's when fall comes along, the weather changes.
It makes my skin crawl. Right. Like, watching all those sweaty guys bash into each other just makes my stomach turn over. So
you're imputing, like, motives to football that aren't there.
Yeah. It's hard for me. Even the language is, like, the names of the players and the things that they're doing. It, like, I think, wow. Okay. I'm not going to say it out loud, but wow. Okay, so, but all those guys who look like they're not all there, it's sort of intellectually, some of them are.
Very smart. Most of them have to graduate. You have to go to college and get out of college to be in a...
Okay, all right. Well, that is also a very meaningful activity. People who go to college are like the pinnacle of Western civilization's intellectual.
You don't. Yeah, there are thought. Some very smart football players.
So those people, sort of directing the political course of our national discourse, by kneeling. Like, I'm curious about how many of them are really worried about something as deep, and wide and profound as institutional racism, which has taken lots and lots of people, a lot of words to sort of try to deal with.
That is like the most paternalistic and condescending thing I've heard you say. Of course, they're smart enough to figure out racism.
Well, no, I know they can figure it out, but...
You're being really snotty.
I feel like it's as fascinating, this whole thing, as watching women unbox their fall box with their scarf and their lipstick. I find so mesmerizing.
I couldn't watch the one you showed.
I'm going to do a video of myself unboxing the Bible. And it's going to, I'm going to do it. I'm going to dress up. I'm going to put on some makeup. And I'm going to unbox the Bible.
That too, you should do that.
In the way that these women are unboxing their beauty products.
I know what's in the box. I've seen these on people's shelves.
I've seen this before.
And I've never seen one open. Now
really,
I have a chance to open
like,
one.
Wanted to, you know, I just knew it was going to be so great.
You have to do get talk, though. You have to do it.
Yeah, I got to, I'm going to practice. I'm not going to do a Facebook Live video because that would be, I need to practice. Yeah. I need to film it. So, well, I think we've covered the gamut.
I think so.
We've pushed the ball forward.
We've offended lots of people.
So, well, our work here is done then. Okay. We'll be back next week.